darkly splendid abodes. The official podcast of Toronto the Libre. Exploring, if you will, practical philosophy. From science and the workings of the mind to spirituality, esotericism, and magic. Stooping down, dipping my wings, I came into the darkly splendid abodes. As we bring Season 3 to a close, Michael and I will once again reflect on our favorite episodes, as well as what we foresee for Season 4, in what's fast become the least listened to episode of every season, the check-in episode.
Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
Love is the law, love under will.
Yeah, no, I don't, I'm not desperate to say anything. I think we've had a great season.
Thanks for joining us, folks. We'll see you next season. Oh, wait, okay. I misunderstood what you meant.
This has been us for today. Yeah, no. Oh, man, you didn't get all my room tone. You didn't get my room tone banter? That was some hot stuff.
No, I got that. I got that.
That was my A material.
It's all downhill from here. Yeah, so this is our final episode for Season 3.
Yeah, and so maybe it would, maybe it helps that we're, it's not that we're going to change format a little, really. We're still going to be aiming for 2-hour episodes, still once a month, still oriented around, you know, a piece of text. So if people have text, you know, nothing by anyone who's alive, but if people have text by dead people that they want us to read.
Yeah, we tried doing somebody who's alive just the last one. We did that little article that, but that was mostly just to bash the article.
That was so long ago, I forgot about that already. yeah, no, that was helpful, I think, to talk about that. But we're going to try to do longer seasons, I think. Mm-hmm. So we're going to try to do like 10 episode seasons instead of 5 episode seasons. And so we'll run 10 months of the year, and it'll actually feel like, and then whatever other talks you have with other people intermittent to that, we'll broadcast sort of as they come up. Mm-hmm. Are you still doing regular features with people like Edward Mason and Rosemary and stuff like this?
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm always open to, doing talks with other people as well, but Rosemary and, Edward both are still regulars, and yourself,
great,
of course. So now that we're completed Season 3, people are starting to actually find out about the podcast. So that's always nice.
Yeah, no, it is nice. And, having that long break between Season 2 and 3 was sort of an unfortunate necessity, but now hopefully we'll be ready to roll. Mm-hmm. This is the last of our pre-recorded ones, and starting next month, you know, next month is July, I guess, probably. we're going to start rocking them out as we manufacture them, so people can expect more regularity on the feed. Look, we ended up by accident. The only thing I said I didn't want to do this season was another series. And we did a whole series on sort of thelemic attainment. And I found a lot of it very surprising. We talked both extensively about the HGA attainment with our paper on Liber Samick, as well as about Crossing the Abyss with papers on the Black Brothers and on, I think, just the Abyss itself, right? Did we have anything on the Abyss itself? Perhaps not. And then we talked about the Dangers of Mysticism paper. So we've done sort of we've had sort of a good summary of what the condition for success is in Thelema.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that? Did you learn anything new this year?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we also had the Three Schools of Magic, and I think that,
that's right,
that helps quite a bit, because there was an underlying theme, as you say, like just to use that as a rooting source, the, idea of Thelemic attainment is, you can't really ignore the idea
that is presented in the Three Schools of Magic letter or letters mm-hmm. in Magic Without Tears, because just the dichotomy between the black school approach and the white school approach is something that's really important to keep in mind.
Right.
You know, just the idea of, as we were talking about in our last episode on the dangers of mysticism, that are described by Crowley, and some of the things that we observed in that article that we're looking at are some of the things that sneak up in your blind spots. And the whole idea that Crowley's getting at in the dangers of mysticism was that magic is a good kind of corrective for those dangers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nihilism versus what I'll naively call self-realization for the moment. Although what kind of surprised me about especially the Lieber-Samek paper on the HGA attainment is the degree to which it centralizes dissolution, that we're overcoming the self even that early. Because I think the way I had talked about it before to people who were curious is that Thelema sort of starts out as a magical, as like a magical thing, as like a black brother thing, almost like a black school. And I mean black school in terms of like the way Satanists and Luciferian think about it, like self-worship. Mm-hmm. You know, you start out with goals and you know, you attain the knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel, which is the crown of all your magic work. And then you become you and you have your true will, which is this thing that you're meant to do. And you go out as the god of your own, you know, cosmos, conquering and to conquer and just fucking rule as an Adeptus Minor. And then a little further up the tree, Thelema becomes like a white school thing where you're much more focused on mystical attainments, on self-denial, and you have to, of course, famously as a babe of the abyss, you purposely deny everything that you are. You throw away your holy guardian angel, all of your attainments. And you sort of become nothing and try to stay nothing as you cross the abyss. And so I sort of thought of Thelema as this two-stage process, beginning with magic and then continuing with mysticism until you had attained the highest rank of both in both sort of projects. And if someone who were a beginner came to me and described it that way, I wouldn't have any serious problems with that. Except that the Lieber-Samek paper is really also about abolishing the ego. You just do it in a slightly different way by invoking the angel so hard that you can't help succumb to it. You know, you try to protect yourself and are unable to do it because the quality of your invocation has been so profound. And so, like, you're obliterated into Ferrith, and then you're obliterated again in what's wrong with me, Ketherhok Mabina. And so I found the whole thing very, very surprising. And it was nice to get corrected. I mean, I don't know. I have more to say about that, but maybe I'll give you a breath.
No,
what do you think?
That's an interesting perspective and an interesting sort of way to look at things, because I think that's probably a common enough way of laying out what Thelema is from, you know, the initial standpoint, the idea that it's like really about, I'm on the verge of saying deifying the self.
Yeah, that's what I said. I think that's fine, except it's just not what we discovered this season.
Yeah, it's that's the thing. It's like that's a deceptive sort of conception. It's not that it's necessarily... Well, basically, it's not so simple as that, especially at the outset. It's maybe there's things that you're doing that are building the self into a temple, but the temple is not the same thing as the god that indwells it.
Well, that's an interesting point. What's that thing we read about? You have attained the I can't remember what it says, but it, you know, you attained the four elements, the seven planets, the 12 spheres of the zodiac, the, I don't know, the 52 tempers, the 100 graces, this, you know, the 75, you know, it's this list of stuff. Mm-hmm. And the how many treasures and how many successes and how many things that, that you went out. And now that you have all those things, you're so big, you basically don't exist. It's like you've become the entire cosmos. And now it's just, now the cosmos is just going to wash you away.
Yeah.
Like, to what end did you succeed in getting all those things? Is it a healthier process than just, you know, brute force denying your own existence right off the hop? I mean, I know when I started out in this, as I had read the autobiography of a yogi, and it seemed clear to me, it wasn't clear to me that the story was true, but it seemed clear to me that the writer believed it.
Mm-hmm.
And that all these people who he had met who could perform miracles, you know, the tiger saint and the saint with two bodies and the saint who ate light or whatever the various chapters are, that he believed he had met people who could do these kind of amazing things. And so I started doing mantra work to overcome my ego and thinking that maybe I would get magical powers out of the deal, you know? I found it very easy to overcome attachments and be very happy with very little. And the consequences of that is, for years and years, I did nothing much that was very important. Sometimes I was depressed, but often I was very contented, doing very little, and had a fairly meaningless life. And then for the last 10 years, I've been doing Thelema, and maybe more anxious, you know, because I have things I want now, and I'm trying my best to get them. And sometimes it doesn't work out, but I feel like I'm in a healthier condition.
Yeah. There's something to be said for the kind of dualistic nature, if you will, of that kind of downplaying of striving and whatnot. Because mm-hmm. there's on the one hand, there's by learning to be content with, you know, very little and not feeling like not feeling attachment per se, and or at least trying to eliminate your attachments overall. That can empower you to a great extent because you can get by with very little and you can, you know, you're not at the whim of things. But at the same time, that's a good way to, you know, going back to the whole mindset of like gurus who kind of take advantage of their guruship and whatnot. And we end up with like cult leaders and stuff. It's a very good way to abuse people and enslave them. You know?
Yeah, I mean, going back to this thing of the Thelema as a sort of system of self overcoming, though. I mean, the definition of magic, you know, the magic is the science and art of
causing
creating
conformity.
Change, conformity,
yeah,
will.
Causing change and conformity with the will.
And certain things that Crowley writes anecdotally about doing sex magic rituals and then, you know, trying to get a little bit more money or, you know, mm-hmm. like, or the act of will where, again, it's financially related, but like, let's say you're $10 short on your rent, mm-hmm. you know, and you're not going to be able to pay rent anyway, because you're $10 short. He says, you just take all the money you do have and you blow it all in one night. You throw yourself a big party and just know that everything's going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And the important thing about this is you were already $10 short on rent. So, you know, it's not a matter of scraping together $10. You're going to get evicted. So... But if you just know with your whole heart and no reservations that everything's going to be okay, you throw yourself this act of will style party, you know, cocaine, hookers, snooker, the whole nine yards.
Yeah.
And then some lawsuit comes out in your favor, and you get a big check the next day in exactly the amount you would need to pay rent.
Yeah.
And so there's all these like little anecdotal things like this about how to get stuff. and we spent the first two seasons reading larger papers about thelemic philosophy and now about thelemic practice. And every paper was about balance one thing against the another, and then they both get annihilated. Mm-hmm. And it's very like none of these papers talk about, like, they don't explain the stories that are told about how, you know, getting stuff.
Yeah.
And the stuff getting feature doesn't seem to be a core feature. Now that we've read as much as we've read, it really seems like even the magical attainments are mystical attainments, because mm-hmm. you're embracing elements of the cosmos in order to overcome the defects in the self, so that you can more purely sacrifice yourself to the divine or something.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this this is one of those things that is kind of worth discussing, and it brings to mind the Cefalù period, where at least after the fact, Germer talks about it to like Jane Wolfe and others in letters and whatnot, refers to it as sort of like an experiment that unfortunately went bad, and and that Crowley had a lot of regret for and that sort of thing. I don't remember reading Crowley talking about it that way, but Germer knew him pretty well and everything, so presumably he's speaking from, you know, direct discourse with Crowley on the subject and whatnot. And I think a lot of that a sense of it being kind of a failed project, I think, came from Leah Hersig and Norman Mudd and even Frodo Achad, who wasn't really there per se, except in spirit maybe. But those three kind of reading themselves into the Book of the Law and getting really caught up in it, and from Crowley's perspective, at the very least, going off the rails and that sort of thing. So I think it's the impression seems to be that the Cefalù period was an experiment in really fully engaging with the literal reality of everything in the Book of the Law and trying to manifest things based on that, and then things going kind of bad. And there's a lot of his sex magic diaries come from just before that period and leading up into it and whatnot.
And, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that's like, you know, hey, that we need to be able to look at that with critical eyes and understand it better.
And much of the stuff we've read that are about this kind of self overcoming, self annihilation sort of stuff are also from that period, right? So, it's all in my mind sort of part of the same thing. And the other thing, just another little nuance that I thought was neat. We talk about ascending the tree fairly regularly. We know it because, you know, there's the AA system is built on that model, and the Golden Dawn is built on that model, starting in Malkuth and climbing up. Mm-hmm. And so Crowley's little sketch of what mysticism looked like, marrying Chokmah to Binah and coming down the tree, you know, the self and the not self wiping themselves out and sort of creating a universe somehow.
Yeah, using the Tetragrammaton as the That's what we were looking at in the eight lectures on yoga, lecture one of part two.
That's right. So there lots of the differences between the HGA operation and the Crossing the Abyss operation, and between magic and mysticism, it's all surprisingly subtle.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting to learn lots about that in a nuanced way.
Yeah. And it's interesting to, like, it kind of lays out the project of Thelema as, yet again, it's important to think of it, I think, if I understand correctly, as an oscillation as a constant going, not as, you know, this is one of the things with the mystical path. And I think I would read it into the dangers of mysticism is the idea that you're attaining to some kind of condition of stasis, like you attain enlightenment, period, you know, and then from then on, you're an enlightened being who's beyond. And even people that I've met in Thelemic circles, you know, working their way through temple systems and whatnot, have fallen into the trap of describing people who are advanced or advancing as getting beyond certain things and no longer being subject to the normal getting sick, for instance, that human beings have to get sick. It's like, well, you get past a certain point, I can't imagine you get sick anymore, you know, and this sort of thing.
Right, yeah. What was your favorite episode this season?
It's a tough call, but I'd say probably the Three Schools of Magic.
Mm.
Just because it's always nice to re-engage with that subject. And like I say, I feel like as much as any one of these episodes that we did, you could almost say it gets to the root of what the theme of the season was. Like, I mean, the Brothers of the Left-Hand Path, that kind of hits on a lot of what came up with each episode. The dangers of mysticism, that came up with. They're almost all talking about the same damn thing, but the Three Schools of Magic really kind of elucidates in a clear way, almost like the tree itself, and then the others are like the branches of that.
I think mine was the Lieber Samick episode. It's the one I liked least while we were recording it. I think I was getting quite frustrated somehow during the recording. I don't know exactly why. But then when you cut it together and I listened back to it, I thought it was great. I thought it was a good summary of the subject and you know, funny and connected. I would like to revisit that paper again and pick a couple of pages and do a real close read.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there's I think there's a cosmology that comes out of them, like a system that would be helpful to really study for a couple of hours.
That's a good idea.
But I think that's a good idea for a second visit. Mm-hmm. I think that for a first visit, that episode was a really strong introduction to the topic, and we said lots of things about the HGA, and which is a concept that people keep deliberately nebulous. It you know, people like it that it's confusing for some reason, and to be able to talk about it straight down the middle was really good. I don't know. Hey Darren.
Oh, hey
Darren.
Oh, hey. I didn't see you come in.
You reading anything good these days?
Oh, thank you for asking. Well, I just I was really happy. I think I sent you a text. I was really happy about stumbling across Skeet's Etymological Dictionary. which is not exactly a thrilling read or anything like that, but
I think it's more of a reference book probably.
Yeah, it's just super. I'm super happy about having it on hand because that's what Crowley was using. He's constantly referring to Skeet and for etymology and whatnot. And as boring as that makes me sound, being fascinated by etymology and all that sort of thing, it's something that is really worthwhile. And especially in this case, we have the source for where Crowley was getting his stuff from. So that's pretty handy. That's pretty cool. But yeah, as far as actually reading stuff goes, I've been kind of in a place where I'm reading a lot of Augustine again. This is one of those things that, like, it's easy for Thelemites to completely be, you know, downplaying anything that's not quote-unquote Thelemic. I mean, even to the point where, I mean, we referenced at one point some OTO-based podcast that was talking about Babylon, and the guy was like talking about, he's like, the next source for Babylon is a very problematic source, and then he's
The revelation super, to John the Divine somehow
he's apologizing for this. It's like,
yeah,
the basis of all of, it's just frustrating. But that's the thing. It's like, I'm reading Augustine stuff. So I was reading my way through De Trinitate, which is on the Trinity, and which I find fascinating because it's like, I want to know what the hell the deal is with the Trinity, because there's, you know, a lot of controversy over that subject. This is where, I mean, you got controversy between Catholics and Protestants, of course, but you also have Muslims have a huge problem with the idea of the Trinity, because it's like, it seems to be praising three separate entities, whereas God is supposed to be one. And where the Catholics claim it is, God is one. They are three parts of the same God. So the Trinity itself is the unity of God. So it's interesting to be reading Augustine and trying to understand that point of view on the subject. Especially because I'm, you know, working on my Latin, so I'm working through it in Latin, and which I'm still not at the point where I can read it completely with ease. I have to keep going back over paragraphs and stuff. But hey, you can find yourself doing that with English. So
we have both started reading Will to Power, which is everyone's least favorite book by Nietzsche. So far, it seems fine. It's just the first 100 or so pages are a diagnosis of the nihilism of the modern age, sort of explaining where it comes from and what shape it takes, and you know, the psychological and political forces involved. And I find myself able to discuss very few passages. You know, usually my first read of Nietzsche it just seems totally opaque, and it's not until I go back and get it the second time that I begin to develop an interpretation. So, you know, if you're reading and rereading in Latin, I mean, you're doing no worse than I'm doing in some English, and it's probably helpful, you know, to be forced to look up certain words rather than just assuming you know what they mean or what the author.
It really does give you a different perspective when you're, when you're doing that, like having to look up words, even in, like, we're looking at Crowley, for instance. People constantly have difficulty with Crowley because it is dense and it's super self-referential and all that sort of thing. But doing this podcast and actually reading up on all the stuff in these papers that we're looking at and everything, I've gotten some really good habits out of doing this, you know?
Do you have anything wise to tell us about the Trinity?
Not yet. I'm also, like, I got a book of Augustine's letters, and one of the things that I'm interested in there is getting the lay of the land at the time, because one of the things I find fascinating is the evolution of the church and different veins of thought within Christianity and everything like that, and the way that it developed and the way that it schismed into different groups, and the way that certain things became doctrine and other things were heresies, and the way that social groups and politics played into it and everything like that as well. Incredibly boring sounding stuff, but super pertinent to the evolution of Thelema. So it's basically, we already have precedent for how things can evolve over time with a philosophy or religion or both. And that's something I've always been fascinated ever since I got involved with groups in Thelema. I've been watching that be an incredibly important aspect to things, is how they unfold in these kinds of ways. And I think it's very interesting to be able to look at, you know, you can see it in Islam as well, or any other group for that matter. You can see how things evolve over time and these predictable kinds of schisms and things that happen. And we can take that and look at Thelema. Now, I by no means would worry about whether other people need to look at Augustine or not, but Crowley clearly did. He named his own autobiography, or autohagiography. He named it the Confessions, and I have to assume that was based on Augustine's Confessions, which was his own autobiography. And Crowley also is commonly, you know, one of the sources for "Do what thou wilt." People tend to look at is Augustine as well.
I think that's great. We've been wanting to broaden our philosophical foundation. I want to get some Nietzsche out of my distant memory and onto the podcast.
Yeah.
Which might be a good reason to read and reread Will to Power in the next couple of months. I don't know. We also have abandoned the idea of doing any Hume.
Oh,
is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Of doing any Hume this season. We should introduce at least some Hume.
Inhumate some Hume.
Yeah. Very good. Have a point. why not some Augustine? Yeah. I think Augustine. I think Augustine would be a good one for our.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find. I'll see if I can pinpoint something worthwhile that'll contribute.
Find that do what thou wilt in the Confessions, and just get us 10 pages in front and 10 pages behind.
Beautiful.
We'll get the whole context of that. If people think that's where Crowley got some of it from, then we'll see what the context of that is.
Why not? That'd be great.
I also want to talk about, I do want to talk about at least the first season of Twin Peaks.
Oh, yeah.
At some point. Because that's, I think there's a lot of evidence that that's Cooper's HGA sort of experience. maybe including the last episode of season two. That's sort of Cooper's HGA go. He's in room, 317 or something at the, 316. No, whatever, 314. He's in room 314. Whatever it is, it adds up to 9. So he's in Yasod after lots of training with, his various AA masters, Gordon Cole and Captain, what's his name? Anyway,
Captain,
we'll have to rewatch it. Yeah, but I think he's doing his HGA work, and there's a question about who his HGA is. You know, is it the giant? Is it Laura? Is it
the guy with the thumbs up that comes into the room when he's been shot?
yeah. That's yeah. So there's we can play with some of those ideas just for fun.
Yeah. That'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah. There was something else that was on my mind that I wanted to hit next season, but now it's gone. Anyway, you got any wish lists for next season?
Yeah, I mean, we had talked about finding Thelemic themes and shows and whatnot, and my suggestion was to do 2001: A Space Odyssey. I don't know that it was Thelemic per se or anything like that. I don't think it matters if that was the intention, but it's like you can look at it certainly as a sort of Tree of Life parable in a very interesting way.
Well, my take on this is that I don't think either David Lynch or Mark Frost are Thelemites.
Mm-hmm.
They're both aware of Thelema.
Yeah.
And I think David Lynch is less interested in occultism than Mark Frost is.
Is that right?
But the fact that Mark has this sort of conspiracy theory brain where he's able to pull lots of threads together, and David just insists on making nonsense. Like he talks about going fishing for ideas.
Yeah.
So he's always pulling stuff out of this deep pool.
Mm-hmm.
The way in which the writing process goes, you know, if Thelema is true, in scare quotes, than many of the true things, the kinds of insights about deep psychology and that Frost and Lynch are going to put on the show are going to have analogs into Thelema, yeah. You know? And so it's not necessarily that the interpretation is the author's own, but that I think it's appropriate to interpret in that way because it comes from this deep meditative place where, for example, the entity that Lynch and Frost call the experiment, I don't think it's hard to say that that's Babylon. And I also don't think it's hard to say that, like, it's a much darker view of that entity than we would have in Thelema. And it's because Frost and Lynch aren't Thelemites. And when they see that, when they see the abyss, they see something else, you know,
yeah.
it's like a confusion of Babylon and the Demon Sea. And so, and I think that, the way that certain other kind of very psychedelic, very abstract sort of where dream consciousness bleeds into waking consciousness. There's a word for this in art, surrealism. Other very surrealist works can be interpreted. Jeez. Can be interpreted along Thelemic lines in a way that might
be extrapolated.
In a way that, so yeah, I'm totally fine with looking at Space Oddity.
Cool. It's Space Odyssey, but
Not the David Bowie thing. Yeah. we can do both.
Yeah, we can do both. So yeah, do you have any guesses? If you want to do any predictions on what the theme might be that comes out in season 4.
Well, here's the question: is whether or not we do end up doing as many peripheral figures as we've just as we just said, and if we do, I think the theme will have to be something around autonomy, like, you know, states' rights versus state rights, natural rights versus state rights, or human, something about human autonomy, something about human psychology, because we're gonna need to find bits and pieces of all of these philosophers who may have fairly disparate views, but that are going to be relevant to Thelema. And if we do something like one of the most famous Hume pieces is this Three Dialogues on Natural Religion, which I'm not sure. If that's the one we take on, I don't know whether or not it's going to be the one that's the most relevant for what we want to discuss in terms of his influence on Crowley. I might be wrong. It may be like, maybe Thelema is the natural religion, but maybe using these philosophers to kind of orbit the drain around around Crowley's paper on duty or Liber Oz, would be a way to go. You know, what
so
are
I can
people...
circle the drain around the duty.
Great.
It's like you designed that.
Mine is two. But something about, you know, what are human motivations, what are our obligations in respect to other people, and, you know.
Yeah, which is, that would be actually an interesting sort of thing to find elucidated through our discussions and whatnot, because I feel like most people that we tend to encounter and discuss any kind of Thelemic political ideas with would tend to not really have that much clarity about how politics really works in practice, in reality. I know that might sound a little bit condescending, but I mean, it's one of those things, people tend to speak pretty reactionarily in terms of politics, you know?
There's words in the Book of the Law, like the word slave, which are unpleasant words, you know? Mm. Don't love this word. Also, this thing about will as a fundamental force, you know, and I think one of the things that was missing for me, coming into Thelema was realizing that there's this whole philosophical tradition going right back to the beginning around the word slave or around the idea of will. You know, the different bits and pieces like this, where Crowley is not innovating and not just being a shit, but that he's trying to contribute to a conversation that's been going on for 2,500 years about what freedom means. And if you're going to talk about the condition of freedom, you also need to talk about the condition of slavery as to be like, you know, what it's juxtaposed against. And so it would be good to get more involved in some of those questions to understand better where Crowley's coming up.
Yeah, I mean, the often cited is the Liber Oz, which is a set of pithy statements about the rights of man, and the idea being that man has the right to do so all these things, and so such as like eat, drink what he pleases, wear what he dress as he pleases, and such controversial things as he can kill those who try to thwart these rights, and move across the face of the earth as he pleases, create, etch, draw, write, craft as he will, all these kinds of ideas, and the distinction between things like natural rights and state rights is kind of an important one to at least have some kind of comprehension of before just willy-nilly trying to invoke rights such as this.
Yeah, I mean, when people think about rights in the colloquial sense, you know, people want to talk about gun rights or speech rights, or, you know, whether or not healthcare is a right. It was fashionable for a little while to talk about housing as a human right. And I would say, well, what justifies housing as a human right? And if one person said to me, well, because it's fundamental, because everything else that we think of as a right begins with housing. Like, you can't have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness without, you know, having a place to live or something. And I, you know, I found that a little bit dubious, but here, anyway, but these are all things that have been enshrined in law, right? Like, they're in various places. And Keith 418 would like to say rights are not gifts from the government.
Yeah.
You know, and so there are things that under a constitution citizens have the right to have, but there's also this idea in philosophy, this idea of natural rights, which are rights that are given to you by God. And, you know, and so those might be, you know, in the United States Constitution version of that might be life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Right? They call them inalienable rights or something. The thing that I have always thought was cool about Liber Oz is that the things enumerated in that list are things that you can just do for yourself, right? You can eat whatever you want without anyone else's intervention. As long as you can buy, borrow, steal, or kill the thing you want to eat, you can do it by yourself. You know, you can speak and etch as you will by yourself without anyone else's help. You know, it's a list of things that you can do if you just have the courage to do them. And then, and the only way anyone can stop you is by threatening you with violence, right? Like, we can't move as we will on the face of the earth because there are border guards, and those guards have weapons and they might imprison you. And so it's kind of brilliant to enumerate a list of natural rights just based on the facts of the case at hand. You know, you have the right to do these things because you obviously do, because who's going to stop you? And then if someone uses violence to try to stop you, then it comes to blows, right? Then we just have the condition of violence. So you have the right to kill those who would thwart those rights. May be controversial, but when you've lived through two world wars and there's a lot of very manipulative political forces going on, you know, I'm not advocating murdering border guards. Like, if you want to go to Mexico, just get a passport. But don't just because they're thwarting your natural rights to cross the border doesn't mean necessarily that you should kill them. But it's within. But these sorts of radical violent actions are within the realm of possibility for Crowley in, you know, in this document and Liberoz. So I think it's I think it's interesting, mm-hmm. you know, to say that to say, because like certain other types of rights, like property rights, are there needs to be a political system, you know, and things need to be adjudicated, like you live in this social contract, right?
Yeah.
And Liberoz shows us what our rights are despite the social contract.
Yeah.
And anyway, being able to be a little bit more rigorous about that, I think, than the way I've been talking about it here would be interesting. So we are at the end of a period of silence as we record this. I don't know if we've had much activity on our YouTube channel or on Apple Music or wherever else we've been. Is there any feedback to respond to?
Let me just see how. Okay, I'm just going to read at random some of the comments that have popped up. It always seemed to me that Crowley's priorities as a writer never included accessibility. He wanted his reader to quote unquote work hard for it. And probably delighted in making the way uncertain.
Crowley says somewhere, I can't remember, that it was very difficult for him to put himself in the mind of the average reader, you know, because he had access to a certain level of education where he had been taught Latin and Greek at sort of, you know, a fourth grade level.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know to what degree he ever got beyond his fourth grade level understanding of Latin and Greek, but it was there for him as a foundation when he needed it. And various other things to do with, you know, I think at a certain point he understood some things about set theory and other mathematical concepts. And when he tries to use them to prove things, he always gets it wrong, which is the disadvantage of not having an internet. But so I think he felt at a loss publishing for a popular audience. It's not that he didn't want to publish for a popular audience. I think he was often confused when he was writing, or at least is what he says. You know, he would write something that would seem perfectly plain to him and then have to read it and reread it several times to think, like, would people understand what this means or not? I don't know.
Yeah, and he would even use novelties to try and find a way to make it more accessible. Like, for instance, when he was doing book four, so he had Sor Virakam taking down dictation from him.
That's right. Later in life, with book four, book four is a little bit different because it's partly channeled a little bit, even though it seems like a straightforward text. He's writing it in collaboration with the wizard Amalant. Ron or whatever his name is, and then they're dictating it to the woman who's facilitating that channeling to sort of get the chapters out. Also, the Book of Thoth, written in collaboration with Frida Harris, mm-hmm. and the Magic Without Tears, where it's correspondences. All of these are an attempt to beta test the writing, right? Yeah. Rather than just writing and rewriting and editing myself, I'm going to have your average reader, you know, read over it and tell me what sections they don't understand so that I can finesse them.
Yeah.
So in a way, he's very concerned with legibility.
Yeah.
And in some places, he says, like, oh, this was written by, you know, he has all these alter egos and stuff. Some works are channeled and some works are written with different attitude. And somewhere I read he prefaced saying, like, this is not by Frater Perturabo. I have found Frater Perturabo to be very opaque and very confusing. And so I'm going to let someone else write this. write this next piece. So yeah, I don't think that's quite right. I think it's difficult because the subject matter is difficult,
mm-hmm.
you know, and what he's trying to drive at is a truth that's, or a series of truths about things that aren't going to be easy to understand. You know?
Yeah. And I think it's also, partly because of his perspective as he's writing is, I mean, inevitably when you're writing something for somebody else to understand, it's some people are just good at that and mm-hmm. others are, have a hard time taking themselves out of their own, like putting themselves in the position of somebody else who's there trying to understand what's being said and that sort of thing. It's sort of like when we were talking about the paper that we were talking about on yoga and whatnot. There was that idea of, did you, like the questions involved, do you feel like you have a stronger awareness than
right.
other people and that sort of thing? And it's like, yeah, of course you do if you've been specifically working on awareness, you know. But somebody who doesn't have that same kind of work put in on trying to foster mindfulness and self-awareness mm-hmm. isn't going to be able to pick up on the same subject matter because they haven't put that stuff into practice, you know. It's like if I'm reading the same paper as somebody else on the subject of some obscure stuff about ancient Rome, I'm going to have a lot more going for me understanding what's going on with that just because I've already put all kinds of reading time into that subject matter, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think that's one of the difficulties Crowley runs into with people coming fresh to his stuff. And that's why it takes several readings to get acclimated to it.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that you need to know as a foundation in order to get to the place where he's innovating.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's innovating at a very high level in a complicated field.
Yeah.
And then also there's a degree to which the modern reader will just disagree with a good percentage of the positions. And so to be sympathetic enough with someone to want to read them, to say like, oh, I really want to learn magic and this guy knows magic, and so I'm going to read this because I want to do it. When you encounter something that seems problematic, you're much, much more likely to begin to try to make excuses for it.
Mm-hmm.
Or to just ignore it even, like to just gloss over. Like, for example, the preface to book 4, Crowley has like 2 paragraphs on the blood libel saying that Jews in Eastern Europe still eat Christian babies.
Yeah.
And the first time I read that, I thought it was a joke. And then maybe I didn't get the joke. And then I just, it was like 20 years later before I thought about it again. and I was just like, what? No, Crowley doesn't say anything like that. It just went out of my head, you know, because it was so objectionable. I just forgot it.
Yeah.
And so in order to understand what Crowley's saying in a lot of places, you have to give up on the idea that you guys will ever be on the same page about certain stuff and confront him as an antagonistic figure while simultaneously understanding that he has a lot to teach you about certain subjects as well. So, you know, our mentors, you know, just because someone's an anti-Semite doesn't mean they don't have lots to teach you about mountain climbing. you know, if this guy's the best mountaineering teacher, I'm sorry, you just have to, they're the ones you have to go to learn mountaineering from, because no one else is going to teach you, is going to have the information. Whether you like it or not, if you want to be great, that's the guy. And we have to deal with these personality issues sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
People can just skip things that are important because they're, and then sometimes, you know, one thing's offensive and wrong, something else might be offensive and right. Yeah, not right, but true, like true in a way that you do really do need to do this. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, if you want to attain Buddhist enlightenment, you need to stop caring about causes. You know, that might not be nice for some people, but it's part of what Buddhist enlightenment means. Hmm. And so there might be other things in Crowley that you're similarly adversarial to that make it hard to understand. Mm-hmm. Because you don't want to understand.
Well, thanks for joining me.
Hey, I didn't like hearing that, so this episode is over.
Wrap it up. No, that's very true. It's like, you know, there's so many little points here and there scattered throughout Crowley that it's so easy to try and come up with justifications for, rather than just accept the fact that, yeah, you know what, there was some of this kind of racist shit going around. Mm-hmm. And Crowley was like, in the case of Jewish people, he definitely knew a lot of Jewish people, and Newberg was like one of his strongest associates at one point in time. He was Jewish. Mm-hmm. And like Eckenstein was Jewish. He trained Crowley basically on mountain climbing and whatnot, and on a lot of yoga practices that really helped him to, you know, break ground that he couldn't break on his own. Mm-hmm. And so like, so you can definitely see that there's weird contradictions at work with Crowley, but he does carry a lot of bigoted ideas around with him and spouts some of the kind of nonsense that was still prevalent at the time, including like blood libel ideas and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, shit. Cut this out if you hate it, but like, here's the thing. Like, I want to use a sort of uncontroversial example so that I'm not stirring up two pots of shit at the same time. Because the one at the tip of my tongue is a controversial example. This is great, because this is also a mistake, right? Mm-hmm. Let's say you believe Saddam Hussein is developing weapons of mass destruction, and that it's very, very important for George Bush Jr. to go over there and like clean up that problem. In a, like, that there needs to be a military operation. Even if you believe that with your whole heart, it is not appropriate to then be suspicious of all Iraqis. You know?
Yeah.
Like, you can't call your cab driver a terrorist.
Yeah. Just because he's all, yeah.
Just because, yeah. And so
it appears that some dogs have gotten into my study.
this is a good example, because like Saddam Hussein was not developing weapons of mass destruction, and there was in fact no good reason to send ground troops into Iraq. And just like you know, George Bush Jr. was being racist when he made that move. You know, Crowley is being racist when he says that, you know, some of the tensions in Eastern Europe are because some Jews are still killing and eating Christian babies.
Yeah.
You know, not all of them, not all of them, but there's some, you know, groups in Eastern Europe that are still taking up this practice. And so in a way, you could say Crowley's is setting a good example by judging individuals on individual merits and saying like, hey, this guy's a great guy. He just happens to be a Jew. I'm not going to accuse him of baby eating just because some Jews are eating babies. You know, it's very difficult to recognize that our political enemies are not also, for example, anti-Semites. You know, here's the dangerous example I was going to use earlier. You know, if someone happens to be critical of certain things that Israel is doing, that it's not appropriate to call them anti-Semites. Mm-hmm. And if you are critical of certain thing, not you, but if one is critical of certain things that Israel is doing, it's not appropriate to behave badly to all Jews, you know, like just because, you know, there's places across the city where, you know, daycare centers are getting bomb threats, mostly fake.
Yeah.
And it just because like people are critical of Israeli military action in Gaza or whatever, and they're transferring those feelings to across the Jewish population of Canada, the United States, and it's terrible.
Yeah,
just like it's terrible when people who are, you know, critical of Israeli military operations in Gaza are then called anti-Semites just because they're, you know, in some degree anti-Israel. So, you know, Crowley can have this horrible misconception, like about Jewish people, and still like them. Is that a good thing? is that an example for the rest of us?
Well, that's the contradiction of it, really. It's like, I don't know. Basically,
I think what I'm trying to say is that I hope it's not a contradiction.
It's not a contradiction that.
I think that if you thought there were 10 really horrible people in Eastern Europe somewhere doing really horrible things, that, you know, you wouldn't turn around and say you like those people.
I see. Okay.
And that other people who had things in common with those 10 horrible people who were not doing horrible things, you wouldn't automatically paint them with the same brush.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, either way, I think we can probably agree that the rumors that Jewish people were eating babies was mistaken.
Yes, that's right. It's a bad thing to believe, and it's a worse thing to, you know, talk about openly without evidence, and
propagate that kind of like
even if Crowley was, you know, good natured enough to hold anti-Semitic beliefs without then being in his personal life anti-Semitic, I think disseminating those anti-Semitic beliefs probably turned a whole bunch of other people into anti-Semites.
Yeah.
Of a less savory description. So anyway, it's bad. Bad news all over. Anyway, I feel like this is deteriorating. Is there anything else you want to say to the people before we say goodnight?
We have the newsletter, and it's basically one article a month, but if anybody has submissions they'd like to make, it doesn't guarantee that we'll actually print it, but we'd be happy to accept submissions for it and whatnot. And you can send that along to thelemite@mail.com, and or just check out our website.
Catch us on iTunes or wherever you fuck up your podcasts.
Thanks very much, Darren. This has been great.
Yeah, thank you. I always appreciate it, and I'm looking forward to the new season and what areas we delve into in the future.
We have such sights to show you.
Feel free, explore.
93.
Thanks for listening. Look for Toronto Thelema on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Watch for events in the city. And join us again in the darkly splendid abodes. Can you do me a favor and give me some levels?
10 out of 10, 4 out of 10, 6 out of 10, 70%.
I could probably dip it just a little higher. How's your headphone?
That's a funk record. Yeah. Dip a Little Higher by Chaka Khan.
Dip a Little Higher by Chaka Khan.
Coming in next on the Top 40 at 40.
Chaka Khan.
Top 40 at 40.
Top 40 at 40.
It's 40 o'clock, and it's time for your Top 40.
See you in another 22 hours. I'm going to cut all that out.